Chapter 6, The Plains of Mengeta. One sorcerer, the ancients say, is worth 1,000 warriors in battle and 10,000 sinners in hell. Drusus Acamian, The Compendium of the First Holy War. When shields become crutches and swords become canes, some hearts are put to rout. When wives become plunder and foes become thanes, all hope has guttered out. Anonymous, Lament for the Conquered. Early summer, 4111, year of the Tusk, near the plains of Mengeta. Morning broke, and rough Galeoth and Tidoni horns pealed through the clear air, sounding at the moment of their highest pitch like a woman's shriek. The call to battle. Despite thousands of Fainim horsemen and dozens of small pitched battles, the day previous had witnessed the reunion of the Galeoth, Tidoni, and Thunieri hosts in the hill country to the immediate north of the battle plain. Reconciled, Coithas Sauban and Hoga Gothjalk agreed to march out onto the northern terminus of the plains that very evening, with the hope of pressing their advantage, if it could be called such. Here, they decided, their position would be as strong as anything they might hope to find. To the northeast, they could shelter their flank behind a series of salt marshes, whereas to the west, they could depend on the hills. A shallow ravine, guttered by a stream that fed the marshes, wound the entire length from flank to flank. Here they had planned to draw up the common line. Its slopes were too shallow to break any charge, but it would force the heathen to scramble through the muck. Now the wind came from the east, and men swore they could smell the sea. Some, a few, wondered at the ground beneath their feet. They asked others whether their sleep had been troubled, or whether they could hear a faint sound, like the hiss of foam in tidal pools. The great earls of the Middle North gathered their households and their client thanes, who in turn gathered their households. Major domos hollered commands over the din. There were cheers and raucous laughter, the rolling thunder of hooves as bands of younger knights, already drunk, rushed southward, eager to be among the first to catch sight of the heathen. Milling on carpets of bruised and trampled grass, thousands made haste to ready themselves. Wives and concubines embraced their men, shrial priests led crowds of warriors and camp followers alike in prayer. Thousands knelt upon the turf, muttering aloud from their ancestor scrolls, touching morning cool earth to their lips. Cultic priests intoned ancient rites, anointed idols with blood and precious oils. Goshawks were sacrificed in the name of Gilgeol. The shanks of butchered antelope were thrown across the god fires of the dark hunter, Husyelt. Augurs cast their bones, surgeons set knives upon the fire, readied their kits. The sun rose bold on the horizon, bathing the turmoil in golden light. Standards waved listlessly in the breeze. Men-at-arms gathered in irregular masses, making for their places in the line. Mounted cohorts filed among them, their arms flashing, their shields bright with menacing totems and images of the tusk. Suddenly, shouts broke out among those already gathered along the ravine. The entire horizon seemed to move, winked as though powdered by silver filings. The heathen, the Kianin grandees of Gedea and Shigek. Cursing, thundering commands, the earls and thanes of the Middle North managed to draw up their thousands along the ravine's northern edge. The stream had already become a black, muddy basin, pocked and clotted with deep hoofprints. On the ravine's southern edge, before the massed lines of footmen, the Enrethi knights milled in great clots. Cries of dismay were raised when those ranging farther afield discovered bones among the weeds, bundled in rotted leather and cloth, the ruin of an earlier holy war. Many different hymns were taken up, particularly among the low-caste footmen, but they soon faltered, yielding to the cadences of one deep-throated peon. Soon the air thrummed with a chorus of thousands. The hornsmen began marking the refrains with sonorous peals. Even the caste nobles, as they arranged themselves into long iron ranks, joined. A warring we have come, a reaving we shall work, and when the day is done, in our eyes the gods shall lurk. It was a song as old as the ancient North, a song from the sagas. and as the Enrithi gave it voice once again, they felt the glory of their past flood through them, brace them. 1,000 voices and one song, 1,000 years and one song. Never had they felt so rooted, so certain. The words struck many with the force of revelation. Tears streamed down sunburned cheeks. Passions ignited, swept through the ranks until men roared inarticulately and brandished their swords against the sky. They were thousands and they were one. In our eyes the god shall lurk. Taking the dawn as their armature, the Kianin rode out to answer them. They were a race born to the fierce sun, not to clouds and gloomy forests as the Norse Arai, and it seemed to bless them with glory. Sunlight flashed across silvered battle caps. The silk sleeves of their calots glimmered, transformed their lines into a many-colored horizon. Behind them, the air resounded with pounding drums, and the Enrithi sang, "In our eyes the gods shall lurk." Sabon, Gothyelk, and the other ranking nobles conferred for one last time before dispersing along the line. Despite their best efforts, it remained uneven, the ranks painfully shallow in some places and pointlessly deep in others. Arguments broke out among clients of different lords. A man named Tronda, a client thane of Anferig, had to be wrestled to the ground after attempting to knife one of his peers. But still, the song thundered, so loud some clasped their chests, fearing for the rhythm of their hearts. "A warring we have come, a reaving we shall work." The Kianin drew closer, encompassing the gray-green plain, endless thousands of approaching horsemen, far more, it seemed, than the Enrithi leaders had supposed. Their drums thundered out across the open spaces, throbbing through an ocean of rumbling sound. The Galeoth longbowmen, Agmundermen from the northern marches primarily, raised their yew bows and released. For a moment, the sky was thatched, and a thin shadow plunged into the advancing heathen line, to little effect. The Fainim were closer now, and the Enrithi could see the polished bone of their bows, the iron points of their lances, their wide-sleeved coats fluttering in the breeze. And they sang, the pious knights of the Tusk, the blue-eyed warriors of Galeoth, Setadon, and Thunieris. They sang, and the air shivered as though the skies were vaulted in stone. "And when the day is done, in our eyes the god shall lurk." Crying glory to the god, Athgieri and his thanes broke ranks, crouching forward on their mounts, slowly dipping their lances. More houses abandoned the line and pounded toward the Kianin. Wainhale, Anferig, Werigin Greatheart, and then old Gothyelk himself bellowing, "Heaven wills it!" Like an avalanche, house after house followed, until almost all the mail-clad might of the Middle North cantered out to greet their foe. "There!" footmen on the line would cry, glimpsing the red lion of Sauban or the black stag of Gothyelk and his sons. From a trot, the massive war horses were urged to a slow gallop. Nesting thrushes took flight, burst slapping into the sky. Everything became breath and iron, the rumble of brothers before, behind, and to the side. Then, like a cloud of locusts, arrows swept among them. There was a hellish racket punctuated by screaming horses and astonished shouts. War horses toppled and thrashed, yanking knights to the ground, breaking backs, crushing legs. Then the madness fell away. Once again it was the pure thunder of the charge, the strange camaraderie of men bent to a single fatal purpose. Hummocks, scrub, and the bones of the vulgar holy war's dead rushed beneath. The wind bled through chain links, tousled Thunieri braids and Tidoni crests. Bright banners slapped against the sky. The heathen, wicked and foul, drew closer, ever closer. One last storm of arrows, these ones almost horizontal to the ground, punching against shield and armor. Some were struck from their saddles. Tongue tips were bitten off in the concussion of the fall. The unhorsed arched across the turf, screamed and swatted at the sky. Wounded mounts danced in frothing circles nearby. The rest thundered on, over grasses, through patches of blooming milkwort waving in the wind. They couched their lances, 20,000 men draped in great mail hauberks over thick felt, with coifs across their faces and helms that swept down to their cheeks, riding chargers caparisoned in mail or iron plates. The fear dissolved into drunken speed, into the momentum, became so mingled with exhilaration as to be indistinguishable from it. They were addicted to the charge, the men of the Tusk, everything focused into the glittering tip of a lance, the target nearer, nearer. The rumble of hooves and drums drowned their kinsman's song. They crashed through a thin screen of sumac, saw eyes whiten in sudden terror. Then, impact. The jarring splinter of wood as lances speared through shield, through armor. Suddenly the ground became still and solid beneath them, and the air rang with wails and shouts. Hands drew sword and axe. Everywhere, figures grappled and hacked. Horses reared. Blades pitched blood into the sky. And the Kianin fell, undone by their ferocity, crumpling beneath northern hands, dying beneath pale faces and merciless blue eyes. The heathen recoiled from the slaughter and fled. The Galioth, the Tidoni, and the Thunieri raised a mighty shout and spurred after them, but the Shrial knights reined to a stop, seemed to mill in confusion. The Enrithi knights spurred their war horses, but the Fainim outdistanced them, peppered them with arrows as they fled. Suddenly, they dissolved into an advancing tide of heathen horsemen, more heavily armored. The two great lines crashed. Several desperate moments ensued. The orange and black standard of Earl Hagerond of Uzgald disappeared in the tumult, and the Galioth lord was speared lifeless on the ground. A lance through the throat heaved Maga, cousin of Skeelt, from his horse and threw him into his kinsmen. Death came swirling down. Gothjalk himself was felled, and the roars of his sons pierced the din. The ululating cries of the Fainim reached a crescendo. But war was bloody work, and the Iron Men hammered their foes, split skulls through battle caps, cracked wooden shields, broke the arms bearing them. Yalgrota Shrankhammer beheaded a heathen horse with a single blow, tossed Fainim grandees from their saddles as though they were children. Werraging Greatheart, Earl of Pleidiol, rallied his Tidoni and scattered the heathen who assailed Gothjalk. On the ground, Gokin the Red, the Thunieri Earl of Cern Ogle, butchered man and horse alike, and cut his way back to his struggling standard. Never had the Kianin encountered such men, such furious determination. Desert dark faces howled against the turf, hawkish eyes slackened with fear. A moment of respite. Householders dragged their wounded lords to pockets of safety. Injured in the arm, Earl Kainia of Agmunder ranted at his kinsmen not to pull him away. Earl Othrain of Numanieri wept as he lifted his family's ancient standard from the lifeless hands of his son and raised it once more. Prince Sabon bellowed for another horse. Across the stretch they had thundered across only moments before, men stumbled or crawled, fumbling to staunch their wounds. But many more roared in exultation, the madness of battle upon them, cruel Gilgeol galloping through their hearts. Their enemy was everywhere, before them, beside them, sweeping in on their flanks. Massive cohorts wheeled in the near distance, charged them from behind. Splendid in their silk calots and golden corselets, the grandees of Gedea and Shygek yet again assailed the Iron Men. Beset on all sides, the men of the Tusk died. Taken in the back by lances, jerked by hooks from their saddles and ridden down, picked like axes punched through heavy hauberks, arrows dropped proud war horses. Dying men cried to their wives, their gods. Familiar voices pierced the cacophony. A cousin, a mead friend, a brother or father, shrieking. The crimson standard of Earl Kothwa of Gethuni toppled, was raised once more, then disappeared forever, as did Kothwa and 500 of his Tidoni. The black stag of Agansinor was also overcome, trampled into the turf. Gothjalk's householders tried to drag their wounded earl away, but were cut down amid a flurry of Kianin horsemen. Only a frantic charge by his son saved the old earl, though his eldest, Gotharis, was gored in the thigh. Through the din, the earls and thanes of the Middle North could hear horns desperately signaling retreat, but there was nowhere to withdraw. Jeering masses of heathen horsemen swirled about them, peppering them with arrows, rolling back their flanks, shrugging away their disjointed countercharges. Everywhere they looked, they saw the silken standards of the Fainim, stitched in gold, bearing strange animal devices, and the endless, unearthly drums pounded out the rhythm of their dying. Then suddenly, impossibly, the Kianine divisions blocking their retreat scattered, and lines of white-clad Shrial knights swept into their midst, crying, "Flee, brothers, flee!" Panicked knights galloped, ran, or stumbled toward their countrymen. Bloodied bands tumbled through the ravine, careened into their own men. The Shrial knights fought on for several moments, then wheeled, racing back, pursued by masses of heathen horsemen, a howling rush of lances, shields, dark faces, and frothing horses as wide as the horizon. Limping across the battle plain, hundreds of wounded were cut down within throwing distance of the common line. The men of the Tusk could only watch, aghast. Their song was dead. They could hear only drums, pounding, pounding, pounding. Dread and the heathen were upon them.
"We had them! Had them!" Sauban screamed, spitting blood.
Gotian seized him by both shoulders.
"You had nothing, fool, nothing. You knew the rule. When you break them, return to the line."
After he'd skidded through the muck of the stream and pressed his way through the ranks, Gotian had sought out the Galioth prince, but had found a raving lunatic in his stead.
"But we had them!"
Sauban cried. There was a sudden shout, and Gotian reflexively raised his shield. Sauban simply continued to rave.
"They broke like children before!"
There was a clatter, like hail against a copper roof. Men screamed,
"Like children! We hacked them to the ground!"
A heathen shaft stuck from the Galioth's chest. For a moment, the Grand Master thought the man was dead, but Sauban merely reached up and snapped it. It had pierced his hauberk, but had been stilled by the felt beneath.
"We fucking well had them,"
Sauban continued to roar. Gotian grabbed him again, shook him.
"Listen," he cried. "That's what they wanted you to think. The Kianine are too nimble, too pliable on the field, and too fierce of heart to truly break. When you charge to bleed them, not to rout them."
Sauban looked at him dully.
"I've doomed us."
"Gather your wits, man," Gotian roared. "We're not like the heathen. We're hard, but we're brittle. We break. Gothjalk is down, wounded, perhaps mortally. You must rally these men."
"Yes, rally."
Abruptly, Sauban's eyes shone as though some brighter fire now moved him.
"The whore would be kind," the prince cried. "That's what he said."
Gotian could only stare, bewildered. Coithas Sauban, a prince of Galioth, the seventh son of old evil Eryit, hollered for his horse. Great tides of Fainim lancers, countless thousands of them, crashed into the Enrithi line and were stopped dead. Galioth and Tidoni pikemen gutted their horses. Tattooed Nangales from Setadon's northern marches cudgeled the fallen in the mud. Agmundermen punched arrows through shield and corselet with their deadly yew bows. Oglishmen from the deep forests of Thunieris broke ranks when the Fainim fled, hurling hatchets that buzzed like dragonflies. At other points along the ravine, leather-armored cohorts of Fainim swept parallel to the Enrithi ranks, loosing arrows and taunts, tossing the heads of those caste nobles who'd fallen in the first charge. The Northmen would hunch beneath their kite shields, weather the barrage, and then, to the dismay of the heathen, throw those self-same heads back at them. Soon the Fainim began flinching from sections of the Enrithi line, from the stout-hearted gay Sindelmen and Curragalders of Galioth, from the grim Numanarish and long-bearded Pladelmen of Setadon. But they found none so fearsome as the flaxen-haired Thunieri, whose great shields seemed walls of stone, and whose two-handed axes and broadswords could split iron-armored men to the heart. Horseless, the giant Yelgrota Srankhammer stood before them, roaring curses and waving his axe wildly in the air. When the Kianine indulged him, he and his clansmen hacked them into bloody kindling. Yet again and again, the grandees of Gedea and Shigek spilled across the ravine and charged headlong into the Iron Men, besetting the Galioth, then the Tidoni, searching for one ill-forged link. They need only break the Enrithi once, and this knowledge drove them to acts of fanatic desperation. Men with shattered scimitars, with spouting wounds, even men with their bowels hanging about their knees surged forward, threw themselves at the Norserai. But each time they became mired in melee, mud, and carnage before the howls of their lord sent them galloping for the safety of the open plain. In their wake, the men of the Tusk stumbled to their knees, crying out in bitter relief. To the northeast, where the common line trailed into the salt marshes, the Padiraja's son, Crown Prince Fanail, led the Koyari, his father's elite heavy cavalry, against the Kuarishmen of Setadon, who had crowded into the ranks of their neighbors to the west and were caught scrambling back to their positions. For several moments, all was chaos, and dozens of Kuarishmen could be seen fleeing into the marshes. Broadswords and scimitars flashed in the sunlight. Suddenly, bands of shimmering Koyari began spilling behind the line, though the Fanail's white horse standard remained stalled near the ravine. Gothyalk's two younger sons charged the Koyari with what horse that remained to them, and the Fainim, without the open ground their tactics favored, were driven back with atrocious losses. Heartened by this success, Prince Sauban of Galioth mustered those knights still mounted, and the Enrithi began, with more and more confidence, answering Fainim assaults with countercharges. They would crash into the seemingly amorphous masses. The Fainim would melt. Then they would race to evade the darting masses trying to envelop their flanks. Breathless, they would tumble back into the common line, lances broken, swords notched, ranks thinned. Sauban himself lost three horses. Earl Othrain of Numanieri was carried back by his household, mortally wounded. He soon joined his dead son. The sun climbed high and scoured the battle plain with heat. The earls and thanes of the Middle North cursed and marveled at the fluid tactics of the Kianine. They gazed with envy at their magnificent, glossy-coated horses, which the heathen riders seemed to guide with thought alone. They no longer scoffed that the heathen grandees were proficient with the bow. Many shields were quilled with arrows. Broken shafts jutted from the hauberks of many men. In the Enrithi camp, thousands sprawled dead or wounded because of the heathen's archery. The Fainim withdrew and reformed, and the men of the Tusk raised a ragged cheer. Many infantrymen, suffocated by the heat, dashed into the corpse-strewn ravine and doused their heads with bloody and fouled water. Many others fell to their knees and shook, racked by silent sobs. Body slaves, priests, wives, and harlots walked among the men, salving wounds, offering water or beer to the common soldiers and wine to the caste nobles. Small hymns were raised among pockets of exhausted warriors. Officers bawled commands, enlisting hundreds to hammer broken pikes, spears, even shards of wood to spike the incline before their lines. Word arrived that the heathen had sent divisions of horsemen north into the hills in a bid to outflank the Enrithi position, where, anticipated by Prince Sauban, they had been utterly undone by the tactics and valor of Earl Athgieri and his Gainrish knights. More cheers swept through the common line, and for a short time they waxed louder than the incessant thunder of Fainim drums. But their jubilation was short-lived. Massed on the plains before them, the heathen had assembled beneath their triangular banners in long, staggered lines. The drums fell silent. For a moment, the men of the Tusk could hear wind across the grasses, even bees as they meandered over the dead that choked the ravine. As they watched, a small party of horsemen trotted imperiously before the ranks of motionless Fainim, bearing the black jackal device of Scaurus, the Kianine Sapatashah governor of Shigek. They heard a faint harangue, answered by resounding shouts in an unknown tongue. Prince Sauban could be heard bellowing, offering 50 gold talents to the archer who could kill and 10 to the one who could wound the Sapatashah. After testing the wind, individual Agmundermen raised their yew bows to the sun and began taking pot shots. Most of the missiles fell far short, but some few made the distance. The distant horsemen affected not to notice, until abruptly one began swatting at the back of his neck, then toppled to the turf, The men of the Tusk roared with jeering laughter. As one, they pounded their shields, hooting and yelling. The Sapatishah's entourage scattered, leaving one figure, a nobleman on a magnificent white, caparisoned in black and gold, obviously unafraid, apparently unmoved by the derision booming across the plain. And to a man, the Enrithi realized, they looked upon the great Scaurus Abnalijan, whom the Nansur called Sutisutadra, the southern jackal. Arrows fletched in faraway Galioth pucked the turf about him, but he didn't move. More and more shafts feathered the ground as Agmunderman began finding the drift and distance. Facing the Enrithi, the remote Sapatishah pulled a knife from his crimson girdle and began paring his nails. Now the Fainim began to laugh and roar as well, beating their round shields with sun-flashing scimitars. The very earth seemed to shiver, so ferocious was the din. Two races, two faiths, willing hate and murder across the littered battle plain. Then Scaurus raised a hand, and the drums resumed their implacable throbbing. The Fainim began advancing along the entirety of their line. The men of the Tusk fell silent, butted their pikes, and squared their shields with those of their neighbors. It was beginning again. Trailing clouds of dust, the Kianin ponderously gathered speed. As though counting drumbeats, the forward ranks lowered their lances in unison, urged their horses to gallop. With a piercing cry, they threw themselves at the Enrithi, while mounted archers swept to either side, showering the Northmen with arrows. They came crashing in successive waves, deeper and more numerous than in the morning. Entire companies were sacrificed for mere lengths of earth. Here and there, against the Uzgalders of Galioth, against the battered Kuwarishmen, the Nangales and Warnuts of Setadon, the Kianin gained the crest of the ravine, pressed the Iron Men back. Pikes snapped, gouged faces, hooked harnesses. Curved scimitars cracked helms, snapped collarbones through iron mail. Maddened horses crashed through rank and shield. And just when the heathen's numbers and momentum seemed to fail, more waves resolved from the dust, leaping through the ravine, pounding over the dead, lancing into the staggered footmen. There was no time for tactics, no time for prayer, only the desperate scramble to kill and live. At several points, the common line wavered, broke. Then, as though stepping out of the blinding sun, the Kisharim revealed themselves. Saban even beated several of the fleeing Uzgalders with the flat of his sword, but it was no use. Mad with panic, they scrambled from his warhorse's snorting path and from the gold-armored horsemen running them down. "The god!" Saban roared as he barreled into the pursuing Koyari. "The god wills it!" His black crashed against the mount of the heathen before him. The smaller charger stumbled, and Saban punched his sword point clear through its astonished rider's neck. He wheeled and parried a heavy blow from a Kianin garbed in flowing crimson. His black stumbled sideways and screamed, throwing him thigh to thigh with a man, though Saban towered higher. Saban smashed down with his pommel, and the man tumbled backward from his saddle, his face bloody ruin. From somewhere, a blade nicked Saban's helm. He slashed the now riderless charger's hindquarters, and it went dancing into the heathen dogs before him. Then he swept his broadsword in a great backward arc, shearing off the jaw of his assailant's mount. The horse reared. Its rider went down. Saban reined his black to the left and trampled the shrieking blasphemer. "The god!" he cried, hacking at another man, cracking the wood of his shield. "Wills!" His second blow shattered the warding arm beneath. "It!" The third cracked his silvered helm, halved his dark face. The Kuyari beyond the slumping man hesitated. Those behind Saban, however, did not. A lance scraped along his back, snagged his hauberk, almost throwing him from his saddle. Standing in his stirrups, he hacked again, snapping the lance. When his opponent reached back for his curved blade, Saban plunged his sword into the joints of the man's harness. Another down. The heathen milled around him, bewildered. "Craven!" Saban spat, and spurred into them with a crazed laugh. They recoiled in terror. That was the death of two more of them. But Saban's black inexplicably reared and stumbled. "Another fucking horse!"
He slammed hard against the turf. Muddy thought. Confusion. A stamping forest of legs and hooves. Inert bodies. Bruised weeds. Up. Up. Must get up. He kicked at his thrashing mount. A great, buoyant shadow loomed above. Iron-shod hooves chopped the turf about his head. He jammed his sword upward, felt the point skid along the horse's sternum, then plunge into soft brown belly. Flash of sunlight. Then he was clear, stumbling to his feet. But something shattered across his helm, knocking him back to his knees. Another concussion sent him face first into the ground. By the god, his fury felt so empty, so frail against the earth. He reached out with his bare left hand and grabbed another hand, cold, heavily calloused, leathery fingers and glass nails. A dead hand. He looked up across the matted grasses and stared at the dead man's face, an Inrithi. The features were flattened against the ground and partly sheathed in blood. The man had lost his helm, and sandy blonde hair jutted from his mail hood. The coif had fallen aside, pressed against his bottom lip. He seemed so heavy, so stationary, like more ground. A nightmarish moment of recognition, too surreal to be terrifying. It was his face, his own hand he held. He tried to scream. Nothing. But there was the thunder of heavier hooves, shouts and familiar tongues. Sauban let slip the cold fingers, struggled to his hands and knees. Concerned voices. From nowhere, it seemed, arms were hoisting him to his feet. He stared numbly at the bare turf, at the site where a moment before his corpse had been. This ground is cursed.
Here, take my arm.
The voice was fatherly, as though to a son who'd just learned a hard lesson.
You're saved, my prince.
It was Kusalt. Saved?
Are you whole?
Winded, Sauban spat blood and gasped.
Bruised only.
Mere yards away, Shrial knights and Kuyari jostled and hacked at one another. Swords rang, danced flashing across sun and sky. So beautiful, so impossibly remote, like a spectacle woven in cloth. Sauban turned wordlessly to his groom. The old warrior looked haggard, beaten.
You stemmed the breach,
Kusalt said, his eyes strange with wonder, perhaps even pride. Sauban blinked at the blood trickling into his left eye. An inexplicable cruelty overcame him.
You're old and slow. Give me your horse.
Kusalt's look soured. Old lips tightened.
This is no place to be thin-skinned, you old fool. Now give me your fucking horse.
Kusalt jerked as though something had popped within him, then slumped forward, staggering Sauban with his weight. He fell backward with his groom, crashed on his rump.
Kusalt!
He dragged the man onto his thighs. An arrow shaft jutted from the small of Kusalt's back. The groom gurgled, coughed dark, old man's blood. His rolling eyes found Sauban's, and the old warrior laughed, coughed more blood. Sauban's skin pimpled with dread. How many times had he heard the man laugh? 3 or 4 over the course of his entire lifetime? No. No. No, no.
Kusalt!
I would have you know,
the old man wheezed,
how much I hated you.
A convulsion, then he spat snotty blood, a long gasp, then he went utterly still, like more earth. Sauban looked around the strange pocket of calm that held them. Everywhere, through the trampled grasses, dead eyes watched, and he understood. Cursed. The Kuyari had reeled away, fleeing through the guttered ravine. But instead of cheering, men screamed. Somewhere, lights flashed, so bright they threw shadows in the midday sun.
He never hated me.
How could he? Kusalt was the only one who...
Funny joke.
Ha 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 ha, you old fool. Someone was standing over him, shouting. So tired, had he ever been so tired?
Kishoram!
Someone was screaming,
Kishoram!
Ah, the lights. A slapping blow, torn links scoring his cheek. Where had his helm gone?
Sauban! Sauban!
Incheri Gotian was screaming,
the Kishoram!
Sauban pulled his fingers from his cheek, saw blood. Fucking ingrate, fucking shit-skinned pick,
Make sure they're punished! Punish them! Punish!
Fucking pigs.
Charge them!
The Galeoth prince said mildly. He hugged his dead groom tight against his thighs and stomach.
What a joker. You must charge the Kisharim!
They walked to elude the companies of crossbowmen they knew the Enrithi kept behind their lines, armed with the tears of God. Not one among their number could be risked, not with the scarlet spires girding for war, not for any reason. They were Kisharim, Endara's water-bearers, and their breath was more precious than the breath of thousands. They were oases among men. Drawing their palms over grass, goldenrod, and white alyssum, they walked toward the common line, 14 of them, their yellow silk cassocks whipped by wind and fiery convections, the 5 snakes about each of their throats outstretched, like the spokes of a candelabra, searching every direction. The desperate Northmen fired volley after volley of arrows, but the shafts burst into puffs of flame. The Kisharim continued walking, sweeping their gouged eyes along the bristling and wreathy lines. Wherever they turned, blue blinding light exploded among the men of the Tusk, blistering skin, welding iron to flesh, charring hearts. Many Northmen held their position, dropping prone beneath their shields as they'd been taught, but many others were already fleeing. Usgalders, Agmundermen, and Gainrish, Numenorish and Pladelmen, senseless to the rallying cries of their officers and lords, the Enrithi center floundered, began to evaporate. Battle had become massacre. Amid the tumult, Crown Prince Fenial and his Kuyori fled the ravine, the Shrial Knights pursuing them through billowing dust and smoke, or so it seemed to all who watched. At first, the Fainim could scarce credit their eyes. Many cried out, not in fear or dismay, but in wonder at the deranged ferocity of the idolaters. When Fenial wheeled away, in Cheri Gotian, some 4,000 Shrial Knights massed behind him, continued galloping forward, crying, weeping, "The God wills it!" They scattered across the battle plain, unbloodied save for the morning's first disastrous charge, hurtling through the grasses, crouched low out of terror, crying out their fury, their defiance. They charged the 14 Kisharim, drove their mounts into the hellish lights that unspooled from their brows, and they died burning, like moths assailing coals in a fire's heart. Filaments of blue incandescence fanning out, glittering with unearthly beauty, burning limbs to cinders, bursting torsos, immolating men in their saddles. Amid the shrieks and wails, the rumble of hooves, the thunder of men howling, "The God wills it!" Gotian was pitched breakneck from the charred remnants of his horse. Biaxi Skoulis, his leg burnt to a stump, toppled and was trampled to pulp by those pounding after him. The night immediately before, Cutius Sarcellus exploded and sent a knife whistling through his windpipe. The first knight commander collapsed, slapped face first onto the ground. Death came swirling down. Brains boiled in skulls, teeth snapped. Hundreds fell in the first 30 seconds, hundreds more in the second. Scorching light materialized everywhere, like the cracks that dizzy glass. And still the Shrial Knights whipped their horses forward, leaping the smoldering ruin of their brothers, racing one another to their doom, thousands of them howling, howling. The scrub and grasses ignited, oily smoke bloomed skyward, drawn toward the Kisharim by the wind. Then a lone rider, a young adept, swept up to one of the sorcerer priests and took his head. When the nearest turned his sockets to regard him, only the boy's horse erupted in flame. The young knight tumbled and continued running, his cry shrill, his dead father's koray bound to the palm of his hand. Only then did the Kisharim realize their mistake, their arrogance. For several heartbeats they hesitated, and a tide of burnt and bloody knights broke from the rolling smoke, among them Grand Master Gotian, hauling the gold tusk on white, his order's sacred standard. In that final rush, hundreds more fell burning, but some didn't, and the Kisharim rent the earth, desperately trying to bring those with Koray down. But it was too late. The raving knights were upon them. One tried to flee by stepping into the sky, only to be felled by a crossbow bolt bearing a tear of God,
The others were cut down where they stood. They were Kisharim, Indara's water-bearers, and their death was more precious than the death of thousands. For an impossible moment, all was silent. The Shrile Knights, those few hundred who survived, began limping and staggering back to the battered ranks of their Inrithi brothers. Inchieri Gotian was among the last to reach safety, bearing a burnt youth slumped across his shoulders. Skardus, knowing the Kisharim had accomplished their task despite their deaths, roared at his grandees to attack, but the shock of what they had witnessed weighed too heavily upon them. The Fainim withdrew, milling in confusion, while opposite a great swath of scorched earth and smoking dead, the earls and thanes of the Middle North desperately reassembled the center of the common line. By the time the grandees of Shigek and Gedea renewed their assault, the Ironmen were again in position, their ranks thinned, their hearts hardened, and they began singing anew their ancient paean, which now struck them as more prophecy than song. A warring we have come, a reaving we shall work, and when the day is done, in our eyes the gods shall lurk. As the afternoon waxed, many more joined the fallen. Earl Wainhale of Curigald was thrown from his horse in a countercharge and broke his back. Skeelt's youngest brother, Prince Narada, was felled by an arrow in the eye. Among the living, some collapsed of heat exhaustion. Some went mad with grief and had to be dragged frothing to the priests in the camp. But those who stood couldn't be broken. The Iron Men had rekindled their song, and the song had rekindled their violent fervor. The pounding of Fainim drums dimmed, then was drowned out altogether. Thousands of voices and one song, thousands of years and one song. And when the day is done, in our eyes the gods shall lurk. As the sun lowered in the western skies, the Fainim flinched more and more from the Inrithi line, charged with ever greater trepidation, for they saw demons in the eyes of their idolatrous enemy. Skardus had already sounded the retreat when the banners of Proyas and his silver-masked Conryans came snapping down the western hills. Without signal, the Galioth, Tidoni, and Thunieri ranks surged forward and ran booming across the battle plain. Exhausted, heartbroken, the Fainim panicked. Withdrawal degenerated into rout. The knights of Conraya swept into their midst, and the great Kianine host of Skardus Abnalajan, Sapatasha governor of Shigek, was massacred. Meanwhile, the earls and thanes of the Middle North descended with what horse they had remaining on the vast Fainim encampment. Succumbing to licentious fury, the harrowed Northmen raped the women, murdered the slaves, and plundered the sumptuous pavilions of innumerable grandees. By sunset, the vulgar holy war had been avenged. Over the following weeks, the men of the Tusk would find thousands of bloated horses on the road to Hinnereth. They had been ridden to death, so mad were the heathen to escape the Iron Men of the holy war. Hunched on his saddle, Sauban watched files of weary men and women trudge across the moonlit grasses, no doubt eager to at last overtake Proyas and his knights. The Conryan prince, Sauban realized, must have pressed hard, perilously hard, to have so far outstripped his baggage and followers. He required no mirror to know how he looked. The horrified expressions of those walking from the darkness were reflection enough. Blood soaked his tattered surcoat. Gore clotted the links of his mail harness. He waited until the man was almost immediately below before calling out to him, "Your friend! Where is he?" The sorcerer, a Kamian, shrank from his mounted form, clutching his woman. Small wonder, looming out of the dark like a bloodied apparition. "You mean Kellis?" the square-bearded schoolman asked. Sauban glowered. "Remember your place, dog. He's a prince." "You mean Prince Kellis, then?" Unaccountably chastised, Sauban paused, licked his swollen lips. "Yes." The sorcerer shrugged. "I don't know. Proyas drove us like cattle to catch you. Everything's confused. Besides, princes don't loiter with the likes of us in the wake of battle." Sauban glared at the mealy-mouthed fool, wondering whether he should strike him for his impertinence. But the memory of seeing his own corpse on the field gave him pause. He shuddered, clutched his elbows.
That wasn't me!
Perhaps you can help me then. The sorcerer scowled in a bemused manner Sauban found offensive.
I'm at your disposal, my prince.
This ground. What is it about this ground?
The sorcerer shrugged again. This is the battle plain. This is where the No-God died.
I know the legends.
I'm sure you do. Do you know what topoi are? Sauban grimaced.
No.
The attractive woman at his side yawned, rubbed her eyes. Without warning, a wave of fatigue crashed over the Galeoth prince. He swayed in his saddle.
You know the way you can see far from heights? The sorcerer was saying. Like towers or mountain summits?
I'm not a fool. Don't deal with me as one.
Pained smile. Topoi are like heights, places where one can see far. But where heights are built with mounds of stone and earth, topoi are built with mounds of trauma and suffering. They are heights that let us see farther than this world, some say into the outside. That's why this ground troubles you. You stand perilously high. This is the battle plane. What you feel isn't so different from vertigo.
Sauban nodded, feeling his throat tighten.
He understood, and for no apparent reason, that understanding roused an immeasurable relief. Two ferocious sobs racked him.
Exhaustion,
he croaked, wiping angrily at his eyes. The sorcerer watched him, now with more regret than reproach. The woman stared at her feet. Unable to look at the man, Sauban vaguely nodded in his direction, then made to ride off. The schoolman's voice, however, brought him up short.
Even among topoi, he called, this place is special.
There was something different in his tone, a reluctance, perhaps, which struck Sauban like a winter gust across sweaty skin.
How so?
He managed, looking into the dark night.
Do you remember the line from the sagas? Emyutiritimauna kimrau saraim.
Sauban blinked away tears, said nothing.
The soul that encounters him, the schoolman continued, passes no further.
And just fucking what?
The Galeoth prince said, shocked by the savagery of his own voice.
Is that supposed to fucking mean?
The sorcerer looked out across the dark plains.
That in some way, he's out there, somewhere. Mog Farrow.
When he turned back to Sauban, there was real fear in his eyes.
The dead do not escape the battle plain, my prince. This place is cursed. The No-God died here.